106.7 Phoenix FM.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Bec Kelly, and I'm here today to host the program you're listening into, which is Real People Talk Autism. And we're going to change the show up a little bit today. We will be talking about autism, but we're also going to be discussing human rights and how our country views people with a disability who are living in this country and are here as either refugees or immigrants. Obviously, there's been a lot in the press over the last 12 months in regards to people who have lived in this country for years and years and years. They've been working here on working visas or sponsored visas, and who either have had a child or who have a disability themselves and find themselves on the end of the government who is trying to deport them back to their country. And we have a very special guest coming, well, not coming into the studio, but who I will be speaking to later on in the show, and I'll give you a bit of information in regards to him. But I want to make it clear that what we're seeing is almost like a continuous effect when it comes to our migration laws here in Australia, where people with a disability are seen as a burden on our system. And I guess what I'm trying to focus on today with today's program is what sort of message that is sending out to our community and to disabled people around Australia. It's quite frightening, actually. But a little bit about the program and about the show and about Phoenix FM. So you can go to the Phoenix FM website, which is www.phoenixfm.org.au, and up in the right-hand corner is a little Listen Live tab, and you can listen to us anywhere in Australia or around the world, which is pretty cool. And, you know, hopefully we've got a lot of listeners today because it's a very important program. Also, if you have any emails that you would like to send through to us, any questions you would like to send, please feel free to send them through to feedback@phoenixfm.org.au. Now, on today's program, we actually have a gentleman by the name of Dr. Siad Abdi, and I would love for people to send through any questions they may have for him. Dr. Siad is an academic. He teaches in at Flinders University. He also teaches online. He's also a staunch disability advocate for people with disabilities who are either in detention or are refugees here in our country. And Dr. Siad is being deported. He has had a notice served on him to be deported within 28 days. I think it's actually less time now, on the basis that he is sight impaired. He's blind. Now, for 47 years, this man has pretty much supported himself and his beautiful family. He has worked in this country and paid taxes, and they are deporting him or trying to deport him. And we need the troops rallied, really, to try and stop this from happening. So if you have any questions that you would like to ask him, please send them through to us at feedback@phoenixfm.org.au. That would be great. Also, you can phone in during music or audio breaks, and I will be playing a little bit of audio because Dr. Siad cannot be on the program until 11 a.m. this morning here, Victorian time. So you can phone through and ask your questions on 03 5444 1129, or you can SMS us on 04 777 51358, and that will actually be converted to an email. So if you'd like to text through your questions, please feel free to do so. As I said, we will be covering a lot today in regards to human rights and also other stories that have popped up in the news. I will endeavour to place all of these links up onto our Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/realpeopletalkautism, and you will also find A link already up on our page for a change.org petition that has started up yesterday, and it's already gotten nearly 7,000 signatures on it to keep this man in Australia. It's important. He is an important, integral part of our society, and he is a fierce advocate, and he needs to stay here. And what I believe is a violation of his rights in trying to deport him back to Kenya. But a little bit more about that later. Now, I spoke about other issues that have come up in the past in relation to people with disabilities and our country trying to deport them. And I guess one of them was a huge story that broke in April of this year. It was the story of a 10-year-old boy who was living in Queensland with his beautiful mother, Maria Sevilla, and they were trying to deport he and his mother back to the Philippines based on the fact that he has autism. Now, what sort of turned that around for them was a young boy who went to kindergarten with Tyrone, actually had his question posed on the ABC's Q&A, and the Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, who, by the way, I have actually contacted today for comment in regards to this case, in regards to Dr. Siat, and I've yet to hear anything back, but if I do between now and 11 a.m, I will definitely read those comments out. But Peter Dutton actually overturned this decision for Maria and her son Tyrone, and they are now able to stay in the country. But it wasn't until they were pretty much shamed publicly in the media and press. The article, when it broke, read in the Brisbane Times. It first broke in the Brisbane Times, and it read, a heart-wrenching legal immigration battle is brewing over 10-year-old Townsville boy facing deportation because of his autism. Maria Sevilla, a registered nurse, said her son Tyrone was like any typical Australian boy, except for the autism he was diagnosed with in 2008. He loves his daycare centre, the outdoors, the beach and the sun. He likes playing with bubbles and bikes like a normal 10-year-old, Maria said. After 8 years in Australia, Tyrone and his mother faced deportation as Maria's skilled regional provisional visa application has been rejected because of Tyrone's autism. Tyrone knows something is happening, but partially due to his condition doesn't understand the potential consequences. One time when we were doing an interview, he sat on our lounge and started crying, Maria said. What's going on? What's going on? He kept asking. During another interview, Tyrone showed a journalist around the daycare centre he attends. He was showing the journalists what he'll miss when he goes back to the Philippines. Maria appealed the visa decision, and last month the federal government's Migration Review Tribunal again denied the application because of Tyrone's diagnosis. Immigration Minister Peter Dutton now has to make a decision on whether to deport Maria and Tyrone. I hope the minister will look at our case with compassion, she said. Tyrone doesn't have a voice to tell anyone. They need to treat him the same as other kids. He needs to stay in a place he feels that he's safe and where he will have a better future. Maria and Tyrone have no close living relatives in the Philippines, and Tyrone cannot speak Filipino. If we have to go back to the Philippines, we will have to start everything from scratch. Tyrone will need to get used to the environment, the people and the language. Whatever he has gained in Australia in the 8 years we have been here, he needs to learn everything again. Maria is a registered nurse who works in the rehabilitation ward at the Townsville Hospital, helping amputees and stroke, spinal and brain injury patients rebuild their lives. I'm trying my best to make a difference, to look after patients that need looking after by a nurse, she said. Beth Miles, Secretary of the Queensland Nurses Union, has made a submission calling on Immigration Minister Peter Dutton to grant the pair a visa, and said Townsville Hospital would be losing a valuable expertise if Maria was deported. It is a regional area, but there is particular skills that are needed. Maria is an incredible, loyal, hard-working mother, valued member of the team in a specialised area of nursing. Ms. Moll said it was important to raise awareness on the prejudices and preconceptions surrounding autism. So many people are on the autism spectrum and many make a great contribution to society, she said. We don't know why there is going to be a problem, and it's inappropriate to assume Tyrone will be a burden in any way. Maria said she is feeling uncertain about the future. I can't plan my own house. I can't buy my own house or settle here, she said. I don't know when they are going to ring me to say you need to go. A spokesman for Immigration Minister Peter Dutton said the visa was refused because the child did not meet the health requirement and it is up to the applicant to seek further review. The spokesperson added, the care of an individual during their stay in Australia would likely result in significant costs on the Australian community. So, that was the article that broke back in April. And then, as I said, the media got a hold of it. Now, I want to play you some audio that came. SBS The Feed then took up the story around the same time that article was actually released. And I want to play you this audio. Please keep in mind that this family has now been granted a visa to stay here, but I guess I just wanted you to get an idea of the amount of, fight or gutso that families face when this sort of thing happens. And it's about the community getting behind them to help, I guess, get the voice and get their word out. So this is called Deporting the Disabled, and it featured on SBS The Feed.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
I don't think I'll be able to, survive without my family.
This is a typical Sunday lunch for Maria Sevilla.
Come on, I'm going to bed now.
My mom's here, I have a brother, I have a sister-in-law, cousin, auntie, uncles.
But her most important family member is her 10-year-old son, Tyrone.
He's a cheeky little boy. He has that smile. He's very affectionate. Even though he doesn't know you personally, probably he'll approach you.
Maria and Tyrone have lived in Australia since 2007. It's hard to believe that in a matter of weeks, they could be deported back to the Philippines. Harder still is why.
Uncle!
What's that?
Uncle!
Sirigel. He was first diagnosed, I think that was around April 2008.
Tyrone has autism.
He has learning difficulties. He's largely nonverbal and some social issues as well.
As a result, the federal government has deemed him a drain on Australia's health system and is no longer allowing them to stay in Australia.
I have assessed your application and find that Ma Cecilia Sevilla, Tyrone James Sevilla, do not meet the criteria for the grant of a skilled regional sponsored subclass 489. It's there's no hope. And you're in trouble.
Maria is essentially living in limbo. Just 3 days ago, the Migration Review Tribunal rejected her appeal. She and Tyrone now have 25 days before they're deemed unlawful in Australia. Their fate now lies in the hands of the Federal Immigration Minister.
If they decide for us to go back home, how am I able to move, to go home? We've been here for nearly 8 years. That's 8 years of our life here. And then we have to start all over again. We've been going to Ryan Catholic Church for 6 years. Tyrone is used to the church there, as well as the people. And they even know Tyrone. So when we go to the shops, they would say, oh, that's the little boy that normally sits in the corner.
I'm hoping that they can get permanent residency, I hope that they can, because she's contributed so much already.
I normally drop Tyrone off to daycare when I'm on an early shift. Tyrone goes to a special school. That's So from starting there and comparing Tyrone now, it's really a lot of difference, like behavior-wise.
I always pick up Tyrone from the daycare. If it happens in the Philippines, Maria will be working. So who's looking after my nephew? No one will.
Kiss. All right. See ya.
We cannot change the fact that he's autistic. Nevertheless, his mom works really hard so that he can have future here. So he's never been a burden for the Australian government.
Since arriving in Australia, Maria has either been studying or working. She graduated with a Bachelor of Nursing and now works as a clinical nurse in Townsville Hospital.
I felt terrified for her, you know. I'm a mother, I've got kids as well. And to be told that your child is no longer, you know, can't stay in the country because of his illness, it's heartbreaking.
Maria should be viewed as a valuable resource that she is. She's an expert clinical nurse, and we need her skills in Australia.
The Queensland Nurses Union has taken up Maria's case.
Maria has already contributed significantly to our society in terms of paying taxes, but she's also paid up front a significant portion of the cost of her nursing degree and is paying that off. And it was only after he arrived in the country that she became aware of the fact that he was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum disorder.
They've referred her case to Hall Payne Lawyers pro bono.
Any requirement that he might have as a young child growing up with autism is something that would be calculated out on a formula basis. Is he going to need this particular medical or community-based service? If so, what does that cost on an annual basis? Let's times that out over basically his lifetime.
It's been estimated that Tyrone will access services in excess of $40,000. But the way in which that figure is reached is deeply flawed. The health requirement is based on a hypothetical person and doesn't take into account any individual circumstances.
There's no provision under the health requirement and the cost assessment process to take into account a net benefit analysis or an offset of those costs by contribution through either the individual themselves who has the disability or their family unit members.
But surely that's not fair.
Doesn't sound fair, does it?
In 2010, a federal inquiry recommended the review process be changed to include the social and economic contributions made by a visa applicant and their family, particularly in cases where a dependent is disabled. 5 years on, little's changed.
Tyrone's got full medical coverage until he's 21 or something. It's all been offered. This is the support they've got. So, there'd be a hell of a lot of people upset.
You know, this isn't an isolated case. It's something the average Australian would not be aware is actually happening on a regular basis. We need Australia as a whole to stand up and say this isn't right, this is not how we want to treat people, and something should be done to change it.
All these are signed petition from friends and probably people that we don't really know. Deporting a family on the grounds that their 9-year-old boy has autism is about as against the Australian principle of having a fair go as it gets.
So I think it says a lot of things about how we view children with autism spectrum disorder. It is the case that he may be able to contribute in many marvellous ways in the future, and we don't want to see any decisions made on the basis of the fact that he might be a burden on Australia. That could be the furthest thing from the truth.
Maria is now preparing to appeal to the minister, but it could be months before she knows what the future will hold for her and her son.
If they're in my shoes, I hope they're not going to feel the same way as I do. If I have the choice, staying here in Australia and him being a regular, a normal child, probably I'll choose that, him being normal. But I don't have that option.
voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
It really wasn't fair, was it? But thankfully, that story had a good outcome. And Maria and her son were granted a visa. But this is a lot of stories that are occurring in this country. And these are the ones we hear about. What about the ones we don't hear about? There was a story that was published in March of 2014 in a small Noosa-based newspaper in regards to a doctor. It read, a doctor with a disabled son fights deportation, and it states, a Noosaville doctor is fighting to stay in Australia after his middle son, who has intellectual impairment and epilepsy, failed the health assessment component of a permanent visa application. Stephen Granderson says the assessment process is flawed after it was estimated that the cost of his 12-year-old son, Tom, to the government would be around $2.5 million. This is even though his family has private healthcare and Tom will continue to be provided for by our family. We are in a fortunate position that we have the skills, experience and financial stability to be able to care for Tom ourselves with no need to access government support, Dr. Granderson said. We do not anticipate being a burden on the government or community. In fact, we would argue the opposite. I strongly believe that we as a family are and will continue to be an asset to this community. Dr. Granderson moved to Noosaville from the United Kingdom in February 2011 with his wife Sarah and three children. He came in on a 457 visa, a temporary visa which allows businesses to sponsor skilled applicants. 2 years later, his employer at Noosaville's seven-day doctors was so happy with Dr. Granderson's work that he was prepared to nominate him for a 186 visa. This is an employer nomination scheme which would allow him to stay permanently. But after going through the visa application process, the family was told Tom failed the health assessment. They now have 3 weeks to gain public support in the hope the department will waive the health assessment decision. Dr. Granderson was aware when he moved to Australia that he would face difficulty in obtaining a permanent visa because of his son's condition. He hoped that he would prove himself an asset to the community. Compassion would be considered. He has raised thousands of dollars for charity, and Mrs. Granderson is the assistant age manager at Noosa Surf Club's Nippers and volunteers her time teaching swimming for the disabled at Nambour Special School, where Tom is a student. So far, Dr. Granderson has had to correspond with faceless and nameless letter writers from the department. He has started a petition and has been urging locals to write a letter of support. He is also contacting his state and federal MPs asking for their assistance. An immigration spokesman forwarded the daily details of the health waiver, which would allow cases like Dr. Granderson's to be considered. The health waiver considers the family's contribution to Australia, the extent to which they can mitigate potential costs and any compelling and compassionate circumstances. So, you know, and there are others. There's, you know, people like the Pasigas. In 2003, a family from Uruguay feared deportation after being told they did not meet the immigration criteria for permanent visas. The Clues, Budrum's Clue family also faced deportation back to South Africa in 2009 after the Budrum family grocer's owner were advised they did not meet the minimum assets requirement, which they argued they did. The Moller case, German doctor Bernard Moller, 2008, his case has given the Grandisons hope. Dr. Moller's challenged the department's decision to reject his application because his son has Down syndrome. Then Immigration Minister Chris Evans intervened, as it was clear to him Dr. Moller was making a contribution to society. And this is what we're going to argue today. And obviously, I will ask Dr. Siat Abdi about these things, because he has made a significant contribution to this country and still is. He has private health insurance. So, you know, the financial costs or, you know, will not come out of the Australian public's hip pocket. You know, this is where we're at. So anyway, so that interview's coming up at 11. You don't want to miss it. We're going to go to news and weather now. And when we get back, I have some audio to play from a TED presentation. So I'll be back soon.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
The news is brought to you by Revamp Computers, providing affordable computers in Eagle Hawk. Phone 5446 3041.
Radio News.
Good morning, I'm Ella Scott. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says the country's anti-terrorism prosecutor is investigating the shooting that has left three people wounded on a train between Paris and Amsterdam. The gunman was arrested at Arras station in northern France, but his motives are not yet known. Two of the victims, believed to be an American and a Breton, have been seriously injured, one with a gunshot wound and the other with a knife wound. France has been on high security alert since Islamist militants killed 17 people in and around Paris in January. Federal opposition leader Bill Shorten says the issue of jobs is central to Labor's economic and social program, which will be offered in the next election. The comment comes ahead of the Tasmanian Labor members' annual state conference this morning. Close to 250 members will meet with party leaders, declaring it is time to move on from the last two electoral defeats and focus on next year's federal election. Mr. Shorten says low employment rates in Tasmania must be given priority.
Unfortunately, unemployment in Tasmania is above the national average. It's around 7%. That isn't good enough, Mr. Abbott. Furthermore, youth unemployment, our future workforce, the future of this country in Tasmania is 9% above the national average.
Prime Minister Tony Abbott says Australia must play its part in the fight against terrorist states in Syria and Iraq. It comes as the Prime Minister yesterday confirmed the government has received a formal request from the US calling for Australia to expand its air warfare role over Syria. The request could include taking part in RAAF airstrikes against Islamic State terror bases in the strife-torn nation. Mr. Abbott says action must be taken against the extremist movement.
This is a movement of almost incalculable, unfathomable evil, and it's very important that Australia play its part in the campaign to disrupt, degrade, and ultimately destroy this death cult.
Meanwhile, the White House has confirmed Islamic State second-in-command Haji Mutaz has been killed in a US military airstrike. More than 600 sharks have been killed across Queensland's beaches in the past year as part of a state shark control program. Despite calls to wind back the program, including the removal of nets to protect whales, the government remains steadfast. The program is intended to only catch sharks in the vicinity of beaches, not actively target them, but has led to the killing of 621 sharks. Shark control measures will remain at the 82 beaches stretching the Queensland coast. However, the government have announced they will release information on non-targeted sea creatures captured for the first time. To sport now, here's James Lemon.
To AFL, the Crosstown Sydney Derby returns to Sydney Olympic Park this afternoon in a do-or-die home match for GWS. The Swans won't let their local rivals keep their finals hopes alive easily, however, as they look to cement a top-four finish for themselves. Meantime, in the NRL, Cronulla will be looking to solidify their final spot when they take on a struggling Tigers side this afternoon. The Sharks will be confident heading in as favourites and will want to bounce back after a poor run against the Melbourne Storm last week. And Peter Siddle silenced any doubt over his selection ahead of young quick Pat Cummins in the final Ashes test. Shane Warne mocked the decision during live coverage, but Siddle's figures, 2 for 18 from 10 overs, are hard to argue with.
You're up to date with National Radio News.
Phoenix FM, Bendigo and District Weather Forecast is brought to you by Look Video Surveillance, Professional, Security Systems, Access Control and CCTV. Look Video Surveillance, sponsors of Phoenix FM.
And the weather for the next few days here in Bendigo. And it's starting to warm up. Spring has sprung. So for the rest of today, Saturday the 22nd of August, a maximum temperature of 17. So nice and sunny morning fog, but it's all cleared and partly cloudy. Sunday the 23rd of August, tomorrow, for a minimum of 4 degrees and a maximum temperature of 16. Partly cloudy with light winds. Monday the 24th of August, well, we're going to get a possible shower, minimum temperature of 6 with a maximum of 15. Tuesday the 25th of August, a minimum temperature of 6 and a maximum of 14, partly cloudy, so the sun will come out again. And Wednesday the 26th of August, a minimum temperature of 7 and a maximum temperature of 14. So that is news and weather on the hour, and it's going to be a big show. So I suggest that if you do have any questions in relation to Dr. Siat Abdi, please email them through to feedback@phoenixfm.org.au. And if there's anything you'd like to ask him, I'm sure that he would be more than happy to answer those questions for you. I have got a list of questions already coming up. So, now I'm going to play a track, and then when I get back, I'm going to play an audio. It's a TED presentation from earlier this year, I think it was, or maybe, no, end of last year, November of last year, which is titled Equality, the Road Less Travelled, and it's by Professor Paul Hunt. Now, what this is about, this talk was given at a local TEDx event at the University of Essex in the UK, and it's produced independently of the TED conferences. And human rights include the rights to healthcare, education and housing. If we are serious about equality, we have to be serious about these neglected human rights, which are really equality rights. Evidence demonstrates these human rights contribute to the well-being of individuals and communities. Using short video clips, but obviously we'll be listening to the audio, the talk argues that there is a new dynamic global movement for the practical implementation of these empowering human rights. In short, these rights signpost the road less travelled to equality and equality for all. Professor Paul Hunt specialises in international and domestic human rights law. He has lived and undertaken human rights work in Europe and the Middle East, Africa and the South Pacific. In 1998, he was nominated by the government of New Zealand and elected by the United Nations to serve as an independent expert on the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Between 2002 and 2008, he served as a UN Special Rapporteur on the right to the highest attainable standard of health, and in 2008 was awarded an honorary doctorate by the Nordic School of Public Health. He's a member of the Human Rights Centre at the University of Essex and adjunct professor at Waikato University in New Zealand. You know, obviously this is more about human rights. I just thought that it's a fascinating TED presentation, and I thought that you all might like it. It doesn't really have a lot to do with the interview that we're about to do today, but I think it's important that we're aware of all of these sorts of things that are happening in different countries as well. So I'm going to play a track first, and this is by Beck, and it's called Everybody's Got to Learn Sometimes. And when we get back, I will go straight into Equality, the Road Less Travelled.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Change your heart, look around you. Change your heart, it will astound you. And I need your loving like the sunshine. And everybody's gonna learn sometimes. Everybody's gonna learn sometimes. Everybody's gonna learn sometimes. Change your heart and look around you. Change your heart, it will astound you. I need your loving. Sunshine. If everybody's gotta learn sometime. Everybody's gotta learn sometime. Everybody's gotta learn sometime. Everybody's gonna learn sometime.
voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Hello, everyone. I used to live in New Zealand, where I worked on human rights issues, and I traveled quite a bit. On one occasion, I returned from overseas, and I walked back into our kitchen, and there our son, Robbie, was playing with a friend of his. They were both about 6 years of age. So Robert and I warmly greeted each other, and then he and his friend resumed their play. Then I heard the friend say to Rob, what does your dad do? And Rob replied, he travels around the world doing good. And then there was a pause and a deep, rather theatrical sigh. And he said, but it never works. And what he meant was that I had to keep going back, right? So evidently I hadn't fixed it the first time. Well, actually, Rob had put his finger on a really important set of questions. Do human rights work? If human rights work, how do we know that they work? We've tended to rely on more of the moral and political and legal arguments in favor of human rights, but not so much the evidential arguments that human rights actually save lives, reduce suffering, and empower individuals and communities. And in my view, if we want human rights to speak to policymakers and practitioners, then we need evidence that they work. Rob's wistful observation, Dad's human rights work perhaps doesn't really work, it raises another fundamental question. What do we mean by human rights? For some years, I worked on civil and political rights. The classic prohibition against torture, the right to a fair trial, freedom of expression. And I conducted cases in the courts in Europe, and I worked on these issues in the Middle East as well. But then an extraordinary opportunity came along. And for a couple of years, I had the great privilege to live in West Africa, in the Gambia, and work for the Africa Center for Democracy and Human Rights Studies. This was in the 1990s. And here I am, I think, showing my age now, on my air-conditioned bike, leaving the Africa Center, and here shaking hands with President Jawara, who was the first president of the Gambia. And I'm accompanied by Mr. Raymond Sock. He was the center's director, now a very eminent Gambian jurist. In any event, working in the Gambia changed my life in several ways. I learned that civil and political rights are exceedingly important, but just as important is a cluster of other rights that I had been completely blind to. For example, the rights to basic education, basic shelter, basic healthcare. And my African friends, my African colleagues, were not only driven by a concern for civil and political rights, they were also animated by a deep concern for these other rights. And in the Gambia, I realized that I had been viewing human rights with one hand over one eye. I had been looking at only half of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, only half of the international human rights treaties, only half of what we all really need for a decent, dignified life. But regrettably, I was not alone. The great majority of human rights workers were only seeing half of the human rights picture. So I began to dig. I began to research. I began to study these other human rights. And I found they had deep roots in all cultures, not just in Africa. In the West, for example, their roots can be traced back to the American Revolution, to the French Revolution. Tom Paine was one of the great thinkers of those tumultuous times, and his book, The Rights of Man, caused a public sensation. It was literally a bestseller. As I dug and as I read, I found that Paine's Rights of Man had two parts. Part one advocates what are effectively civil and political rights. Unfortunately, most of us stop reading at the end of part one. This is a great pity. Keep reading, because part two of The Rights of Man advocates something very close to the other rights that I had to go to the Gambia to learn about. For example, very briefly, in the second part of The Rights of Man, Paine advocates a system for educating the children of the poor. And he emphasizes that what he envisages is not charity, he says, but a right. Let me fast forward 150 years to President Roosevelt. FDR championed what he called the four freedoms, one of which was freedom from want. Eleanor Roosevelt steered the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through the United Nations with great skill. FDR, Eleanor Roosevelt, and most Western countries grasped that deep deprivation, profound inequalities, contributed to the growth of fascism in the 1930s. And in the 1940s, they realized that securing these other rights, education, shelter, healthcare, might possibly stop history repeating itself. Have we forgotten that lesson? Fascist-like authoritarianism comes in many secular and religious forms, and they don't spring from nowhere. To return to my story, just a few years after the Second World War, Martin Luther King Jr. understood the importance of these other rights. He knew the elimination of inequality needed more than civil and political rights. He said, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane." And just last year, President Barack Obama emphasized regular access to a doctor or medicine or preventive care. That's not some earned privilege, it's a right. That's the language of Tom Paine. And as I dug deeper, it became clear that almost everyone who had called for these other rights shared a common idea. And this idea is as powerful and vital today as ever. They all shared a vision of meaningful equality. they were not only talking about formal equality, that is, equality before the law, although that's hugely important. They were also talking about equality so the disadvantaged enjoy the same life chances as everyone else. And this is what the other rights are about. Meaningful equality for all. These other rights are really equality rights. During my digging, during my research, I wrote a book called Reclaiming Social Rights. That's what human rights law calls these rights, social rights. But I might have called the book Reclaiming the Other Rights or Reclaiming Equality Rights. And as we all know, in many countries, there is no meaningful equality between rich and poor, between one ethnic group and another, between men and women, people with and without disabilities, and between some other social groups. I won't try to list them all. Billions of people do not enjoy equal life chances, and the majority of them are women and girls. The rights to education, to shelter, healthcare, and other equality rights aim to provide, as far as possible, the same life chances for all. Some say these rights are not realistic. I strongly disagree. Of course, a government cannot build an education system overnight. It takes money. It takes time. But the right to education recognizes that. It allows a government to build an inclusive, quality education system over a period of time. That's what the right to education says. But the right to education requires that the government be held accountable for its progress, or perhaps for its lack of progress. It seems to me that's realistic, isn't it? So, what do we mean by human rights? Of course, we mean civil and political rights, but in addition, we mean the other rights, equality rights, such as the rights to basic education, shelter, and healthcare. But still, I've got Robert's question. Do human rights work? Do equality rights work? So here, others will speak, and you decide for yourselves. For many years, Peru has suffered from a very high maternal mortality rate, especially among indigenous women. There is now a range of measures to reduce maternal mortality in Peru. And to some degree, these measures are working. Fewer women are dying in childbirth. Of course, there's still a long way to go. Phil Borge has made a film about a maternal health initiative in Peru. It's organized by CARE. And this initiative has several elements, all explicitly shaped by health rights. So here is a very short clip from Phil's beautifully shot film about just one part of the CARE initiative.
Guillohannia raises llamas and sheep on the high plains of southern Peru. Like most Quechua women, she gave birth to her three children at home. She just didn't see any benefit to going into the local health post. 3 years ago, she began training with CARE to become a citizen monitor, or what they call a vigilante. One day a week, she rides 6 miles to the health post to volunteer her services. Her presence builds the trust between the healthcare providers and their clients. That trust is the key to the extraordinary improvement that has taken place in Peru's maternal health program.
At first, the women did not trust the health post. The doctors did not speak our language or honor our traditional methods of birthing. I asked the women, do you trust the treatment you are getting? Does the doctor speak Quechua? Do they treat you with respect?
The suggestions and complaints that Eugenia and other vigilantes gather help create the understanding of the Quechua views and traditions. Their findings are then sent to Peru's health ministry to be addressed.
For me, it was very important to learn about my rights in the trainings. It meant that women didn't have to limit ourselves to the home. We could go out and have responsibilities with groups. We could go and speak with authorities about what we need and want. This has given me strength.
What a brilliant strategy. An army of volunteer women. Women empowered just by learning their rights and getting a forum to share their insights. They are now bridging the cultural divide that had kept women from seeking and obtaining the health care that they were entitled to.
Let's leave the Sierra and travel down to Lima on the coast. Earlier this year, I visited some governmental, that is public, health facilities in a favela in East Lima. Here I met the inspirational Dr. Luis Fuentes, and he and his colleagues explained how they use health rights in their work. And here is a very, very short extract from a recent interview with Dr. Fuentes, with many thanks to Agustin Diaz.
La esencia del derecho a la salud está en considerar al otro como una persona. Lo que estamos haciendo en esta parte de Lima Este es acciones de salud con el pleno consentimiento y participación de los ciudadanos. Hemos mejorado la disponibilidad de servicios, mayor cantidad de recursos humanos, profesionales y técnicos capacitados, la asequibilidad, el tema económico a través del aseguramiento universal, la adaptabilidad cultural a través de estos intérpretes quechohablantes, la plena participación de la comunidad y del gobierno local corporativo. Para nosotros los derechos humanos inclusive van en los extremos, en las personas que han perdido su libertad, porque han perdido su libertad, pero no su derecho a vivir. Y hemos conseguido en virtud de esto hacer abogacía para que las condiciones de los que brindan atención dentro de los penales y las personas afectadas estén en mejores condiciones para ver el tema de tuberculosis. En salud, nosotros debemos velar porque la vida de todos los ciudadanos sea considerada como digna.
Dr. Fuentes mentioned their use of interpreters, and here's a diminutive Quechua woman and her interpreter in one of the health facilities. Unfortunately, as you can see, I think we're rather terrifying her. To leave Peru, however, the power of these equality rights extends to high-income countries like the United Kingdom. In Northern Ireland, as some of you might know, there's a terrific organization called the Participation and Practice of Rights. And PPR runs a number of projects that are driven by equality rights. And one project concerns 7 high-rise blocks of flats in Belfast. They're called the Seven Towers, which sounds something like something from the Lord of the Rings, and certainly not from the Shire. But here, some of the residents talk about their human rights campaign for improvements to the Seven Towers.
In order to judge if the housing executive were meeting our rights, we decided to monitor if things got better or worse for residents over 12 months. In order to ensure real participation, i.e. that residents were deciding how our rights could be made real, we chose the issues we wanted to see improvement on. The issues we want to plan to monitor are as follows. Pigeon waste, families in the Seven Towers, dampness and mould, drainage and sewage problems, residents' satisfaction of the Northern Ireland Housing Executive's response to maintenance problems, participation and involvement of residents in decisions made about their housing. In May of this year, following the survey, the Northern Ireland Housing Executive informed the local housing forum that they plan to do a major renovation of the flats, which they say will deal with many of the issues listed above.
Today we met up with Margaret Ritchie, the new housing minister, and she herself today committed to helping us, the Seven Towers residents, with our indicators.
The hearing received wide coverage in the local and national media. On the 3rd of July, in response to the hearing, the current minister with responsibility for housing, Ms Margaret Ritchie, visited the residents in the new lodge to receive a presentation on their work. In addition to commending the work of the residents, the minister made a commitment to ensure that the housing executive tackled the issues in accordance with the human rights indicators and the benchmarks set by the residents.
I could give you hundreds of examples from all corners of the world. Of course, these short clips aren't, in quotes, scientific, but they tell a really important human rights story. And that story is about care and compassion. It's about decency and dignity. It's about agency and accountability. It's about participation and empowerment. Data, numbers, have a vital role to play, but they cannot tell the whole human rights story. The World Health Organization recently published a book which looks at the impact of human rights on women's and children's health. This research was led by WHO Assistant Director General Dr. Flavia Bustreo and myself. The book has over 30 co-authors from many countries. It demonstrates that human rights contribute to health gains for women and children. And it concludes that we urgently need more research on human rights impact. The book sets out ways to conduct this multidisciplinary research. Ladies and gentlemen, a global movement is gathering pace. It's empowering, it's exciting, it's diverse, and as we've seen, it already reaches into the mountains and the favela and into other disadvantaged communities. And at the heart of this movement are the other rights, social rights, equality rights. And while this movement gains inspiration from the past, it must be forward-looking. It must use the opportunities provided by information technology, social media, big data. The other rights, social rights, equality rights, they signpost the less traveled road to greater equality. What Robert will make of this afternoon's work, well, we'll have to wait and see. Thank you very much.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Sponsors of Phoenix FM. Electricity prices in Victoria continue to rise at an alarming rate, causing fear and uncertainty for families and businesses. You can protect your family and your business against these concerns by switching to Solar Today. Solar Today is an innovative market leader and one of Victoria's older solar companies, sourcing quality products and latest technologies. We're excited to announce that we can now offer for the first time an affordable, complete energy solution that includes solar panels, new and exclusive battery system that can be fitted with new or existing solar systems, hot water, and generous government rebates averaging between $2,000 to $4,000 are still available. We can show you how solar makes great financial sense. You may be amazed at how good this investment is. Please call Solar Today for a free no-obligation presentation on 1300 211 374. Special offers for the first 30 callers of up to $1,000 in vouchers of your choice.
Sponsor.
The Williams and Street General Store for hot and cold takeaway food, milk, groceries, or a famous Tunnock slice. The Williams and Street General Store for your papers, refreshing drinks, and they're open 24 hours a day. 142 Williamson Street, Bendigo. 5443 8071. Station sponsor.
Sponsor.
Hey, Murray, where are you?
Over here on the power line.
Ah, gotcha.
How's it going, mate?
10 cars and a pedestrian.
Ooh. Check out the red car.
It's mine. I saw it first.
No, mate. No, not that one.
Why not?
Perro's paint, mate.
Perro's?
Yeah, have some respect. Look at the finish, the shine. You just can't do it.
Sorry, mate. I just wasn't thinking.
Hey, a cyclist. Or racer. Let's get him.
Birds all over the world respect Perro's quality automotive paints and accessories.
47 Breen Street, Bendigo.
Sponsors of Phoenix FM. The Scottish Banner is Australia's only Scottish monthly publication. Each month, it offers news from home, historical facts, crosswords, pipe band news, local events, updates, and much, much more. Get your banner at your local newsagents or go online at info@scottishbanner.com. The Scottish Banner, station sponsor.
And
I'm back. I hope you enjoyed that. So in about 20 minutes' time, we will be speaking with Dr. Siat Abdi, who is a man who has been living in Australia for the last 11 and a half years. He has been told that he has now less than 28 days to leave our country. He's being deported on the basis of his disability, which I find absolutely abhorrent. We'll be speaking with him in about 20 minutes' time, which is... I'm really excited about. He's just such a lovely man, and you will all get to hear that for yourself. I want to also tell you about a wonderful local business here in Bendigo, which is called Organic Town. It's actually run, so this is completely separate, but it's completely run by a parent who has children with autism, and it supplies the Bendigo community with organic produce. It's called Organic Town, and it's so exciting, but they're running a competition at the moment. Now, Organic Town have these fantastic diffusers, electric diffusers, and if you go onto the Organic Town Facebook page, you'll see like a like, share and comment competition that's going on at the moment. These diffusers are awesome, absolutely awesome. You can put any kind of oils in it, but have a look on the page too. There's some great things on offer. If you like your food organic and clean, and also your products organic and clean, this is the place for you. They offer free postage in Bendigo, or free delivery, sorry, not postage, free delivery in Bendigo, which is pretty cool. And also the person who owns it's a pretty cool person too. I think she's pretty amazing. So get on to Organic Town, check out what they've got. Yeah, you'll be really surprised at what Organic Town has to offer. But also get in and like, share and comment what colour diffuser you would like to win one of these fantastic diffusers. Absolutely amazing. Now I want to play a song, for a friend who's doing it tough at the moment. She's an Aussie parent. And I love her very much. And this song is for my friend Kelly. So enjoy this song, and I'll be back soon.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Try your best, but you don't succeed. When you get what you want, but not what you need. When you feel so tired, but you can't sleep. Stuck in reverse. tears come streaming down your face. When you lose something you can't replace. When you love someone but it goes to waste. Could it be worse? You never try, you'll never know just what you were. Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones.
Voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
And that was Coldplay's Fix You and for my dear friend Kelly. I hope you're feeling better soon. Okay, so we're coming into the bottom end of the hour, and from 11 a.m. our time, I will be speaking with a Kenyan father who's lived in Australia for the last 11 and a half years. He's been a teacher. He has also been a tutor, as well as a disability advocate, advocating for the rights of migrants with disability. And I guess what's happening to him is that you know, it's quite scary too for the people that he advocates for. Our Australian government is trying to deport Dr. Siat Abdi back to his home country in Kenya, giving him, now this was probably about a week or so ago, or 2 weeks ago, but we'll ask him, we'll clarify that, giving him 28 days to leave the country. Now, obviously, he has rejected that and he's appealed it. You know, we're going to find out a little bit more. And I want, you know, all our listeners just to hear how wonderful this man is and the wonderful contributions he makes to this country. Not based on his sight impairment, but based on him as an individual. There was an article that came up on SBS, that also had a video that with it, and I would like to play you the audio from that video in relation to Dr. Siat. And you know, you get to have a kind of, you get a feel of the kind of beautiful human being he is. So have a listen to this, and we'll be back soon.
They say they've made a contribution, haven't relied on welfare, but Dr. Abdi is blind, so he can't stay.
Here I am, I'm told that I'm a burden to the society. That really makes me so angry.
Dr. Abdi's visa application was rejected partly because he would be eligible for the disability support pension.
I've been working, I've been working hard to support my family here and those in Kenya.
Dr. Abdi will appeal, but he knows it'll fail. The Migration Act is clear. An applicant must be free from a condition that would be likely to require healthcare or community services. Disability advocates say the Act should consider the net benefit of a migrant.
Even on a productive diversity basis, he is going to be far more productive and far more beneficial to this country than any cost that can be attributed to his condition.
Mr. Rajan says Australia is also in breach of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
It's dehumanising and it breaches every right of humanity that we have in existence.
A parliamentary inquiry recommended the Migration Act be amended 5 years ago, but successive governments have made few changes.
We should just get it done and get it done quickly and allow for people of all abilities to be able to stay in Australia and contribute to the country.
The Immigration Department says when a health waiver isn't applicable under a visa application, then an individual's circumstances cannot be considered under the Act. Only the Minister can do that. Dr. Abdi hopes the Minister will do that for him. And what he really wants is the law to reflect the fair go of Australian society. Ryan Emery, SBS World News.
So that featured on SBS World News on the 19th of August, so a couple of days ago, and it came along with it with an article. Now, you heard the voice also of a gentleman by the name of Suresh Rajan. Now, he you know, obviously is advocating very hard for this, but he did say something very interesting there, that our Migration Act is in breach of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, to which our country is a signatory. And so I will pose that question to Dr. Siat when we speak with him. I'm sitting here shaking my head, just going, why is this happening? Why is this happening? I wish that Peter Dutton would have contacted me. I actually did send our immigration minister an email with some questions asking some what I believe pretty hard questions that I think needs to be answered, and also I also sent it to, emails to the Shadow Immigration Minister Richard Marles, as well as Jenny Macklin, who is the Minister for Disabilities, or the Shadow Minister for Disabilities. and our very own Lisa Chesters. And I spoke with Lisa in regards to this yesterday, and she cannot believe that this is going on in our country. And it's a continual thing that keeps happening. And as I said, you know, what sort of message is that sending out to people with disabilities in this country? What sort of message are we, sending the world in regards to human rights? These are questions that I would love answered. And Mr. Dutton, if you are listening, please feel free to send the answers to my questions through, and I'd be more than happy to invite you to come on the show next week if you would like and discuss this with me on the program. And that invitation extends also to Richard Marles as well as Jenny Macklin. It would be great to hear from government on how they believe that this is actually right. Somebody who's lived in this country for 11 and a half years, who has been employed and paid taxes, who fights for the rights for migrants with disabilities, who teaches our Australian community, our Australian public, you know, this man holds a PhD, who has private health insurance. How is he considered a burden in their eyes? How I just don't understand how any of this works. I really don't. It's quite upsetting, actually. Anyway, I'm going to play a track, and when we come back, hopefully, I will be speaking with Dr. Siat Abdi.
We'll do it all, everything on our own. We don't need anything or anyone. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? I don't quite know how to say how I feel. Those three words I said too much, they're not enough. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? Forget what we're told before we get too old. Show me a garden that's bursting into life. Let's waste time chasing cars around our heads. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
And that was Snow Patrol with Chasing Cars. Now, as I've been telling everybody all morning, there's some... Hello. Yes, I've got Dr. Siat Abdi on the phone. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Considering what's going on, we had a bit of a chat last night, and I got off the phone to you last night, and I said to my husband, I can't understand why this is happening. I can't, and I went through all the logic. I went through all of the articles and everything that's come up. I've played a lot of the audio, especially from SBS that went to air a couple of days ago, the interview that they did. And by the way, your children are just gorgeous.
Thank you.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
But you know, obviously it's struck a nerve with the community in general, not just the disability community and advocacy community, but also just the Australian community, that this could be happening to somebody that has made such a huge contribution to our country for the last 11 and a half years. So I guess the first question, I've actually been sent a question from someone that has asked how you came to be in Australia 11 and a half years ago.
Well, I came under the student visa category, and I came through a scholarship, very prestigious scholarship, which I was selected from 28 students in East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, and I really had to go through a very tough competition out of 2,600 applicants who... without a disability, and it happened that I was the only person with a disability to get that scholarship. So through that scholarship, initially I was supposed to go to United States to do my PhD. But I, because of the weather there, I opted, I said, no, go to Australia. So I made the choice to come to Australia, to come and study and make a difference. So after finishing my study, I felt, well, my service is needed here in Australia. So I applied for a skilled visa, 457 visa. But due to my disability, that was supposed to be rejected. But I went ahead and applied for it, and it was rejected. I went through the tribunal. It was also rejected. Then there was a ministerial intervention. Chris Evans, at that time, gave me a ministerial intervention, and gave I really appreciated, and he gave me 457 long stay visa. Then I stayed in visa in Australia, South Australia, worked in South Australia for since 2009 up to 2012. I was based in South Australia, and I worked there in various sectors. I was lecturing at Flinders University. I also did a sessional tutoring as well, and also supervised quite a number of students at Cambridge College who were doing community welfare at that time. And after finishing 2012, I got a position here in WA, Western Australia, to come and do advocacy work. And I applied for a systemic advocacy position. And I left my position as lecturing, and therefore remained with my sponsor and through my employer, and who really sponsored me for permanent residency through 187 visa entry. So all that time I was not reunited with my five children, actually the one adopted child and the four other children in Kenya from my previous marriage. And mm-hmm. they are now grown up, teenagers. All mm-hmm. of them are now teenagers, and they have not seen me for 11 years.
Mm.
And you can imagine that. And all along, I've been supporting them all that. So
yeah.
That's how I came to Australia. That's how I started my work, and I'm engaging with the communities.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I satisfy that question, but...
Oh, no, definitely. Beautifully. Yes. Beautifully. Yes. Absolutely beautifully. You mentioned your advocacy work,
yes.
Which you are very well known for.
Yes.
Tell us about what kind of work that entails. Like, what sort of advocacy work are you actually doing currently in WA?
At the moment, I'm doing systemic advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
And systemic advocacy really involves influencing change. And that's what is happening. We find a lot of issues that are happening within the disability sector,
mm-hmm.
including policies. People come up with legislations that are sometimes very, very disadvantaging people with a disability in terms of access and inclusion, whether it's access and inclusion, whether it's issue of transport, whether it's issue of housing, accommodation, mental health. All these things are some various departments, government and private sectors, keep up some kind of policies in relation to services, but those services, if they are not in relation to what are the aspirations and the need of people with a disability, then they need to change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I normally do. I feed in some feedback information, reports, I do my advocacy through that systemic work.
Yeah. So you advocate for people with disabilities here in Australia.
Yes.
So are they just Australian people, or these are migrants that you are advocating for?
I advocate for people from ethnic background,
yep.
Cultural and linguistically diverse population, people with a disability from cold background.
Mm.
But I still also do the mainstream, you know, sometimes, you know, because there is an intersection. We can't divorce issues that are affecting the mainstream and the issues that are affecting cold people with a disability.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's great work, and I'm still trying to get my head around this government decision. So you mentioned that you have a PhD, and I want to make it clear to our listeners too, Dr. Siat, that you have a PhD. You got that qualification, obviously, here in Australia, yes?
Yes.
And so you were able to attend school here in Australia. There was no problem whatsoever with the government, with you coming here and doing your PhD and everything here in Australian universities.
Yes. There was no problem with that.
None. Okay,
yes.
So let's get to what's happening at the moment. So when were you informed of the government decision to, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but for you to be deported?
Well, actually, it didn't come directly like that issue of deportation. But,
yeah.
You know, normally when they make a decision, they normally give you those two options.
Mm-hmm.
You either leave the country within 21 days after expiry of your bridging visa, because I was staying all along that was in the application. I was staying on a bridging visa. And once the bridging visa expires within 28 days sometimes, because there is a leeway of the 1 week that they normally provide,
mm-hmm.
then you have to leave. That's the legislation. And otherwise, they also give you an option to apply for the what is called the Administrative Appeal Tribunal, the division of the Migration Review Tribunal. Because there's a division there.
Mm.
There's now they have amalgamated. Before, it used to be Migration Review Tribunal or Refugee Review Tribunal. But both these divisions have now amalgamated to form one body.
Mm-hmm.
They call it AAT, A-A-T, Appeal, Appeal Administrative Appeal Tribunal. So you are given that option to appeal,
mm-hmm.
which I have quickly done so, because I don't want within 21 days me be deported from the country.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you've
but
now...
But it will not make, the decision will not make such a difference, because the tribunal will obviously review from the point that from the what's in the comment of the Commonwealth medical officer who says that I don't satisfy the health criteria.
Mm. And this is the sticking point, isn't it, with the Migration Act,
exactly.
Is this health criteria that,
yes.
that keeps popping up, because your case is one of many that is people are facing in this country at the moment.
Exactly.
People with disabilities are being given, you know, these options of you have to leave the country based on this health section of the Migration Act, and it's my understanding in listening to what Suresh said in the interview for SBS that the Act is actually the Migration Act is in breach of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Do you agree with that?
Yes. It's a total breach of the migration of the Convention for the Rights of People with Disability in all its aspects, because all the acts actually doesn't satisfy quite a number of acts, because quite a number of articles in the Act, like for example, issues of the right for individuals to live wherever they want to stay, whatever the kind of their disability. That Act is really totally breached, you see things like other services, there are quite a number of articles, Article 5, Article 18, Article 24. There are quite a number of articles that are really in breach of this Migration Act. And even in our country here, and the national, the Disability Discrimination Act, the Disability Discrimination Act is not answerable to the Migration Act, and that makes it everything complicated.
Mm.
Yes.
Because, you know, we've seen cases that have been overturned when the immigration minister has intervened, and on a case-by-case basis. And do you think that this is pretty much the only way that your case is going to be overturned, as if Peter Dutton steps in and...
Yes, this is the only way. This is the only way to have a ministerial intervention.
I'm not talking...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm speaking over you. But, when we look at the big picture here, Dr. Siat, you're not somebody who's living on a disability pension or anything like that here in this country.
Yeah.
You're actually someone who's been paying taxes...
Yeah.
And if correct me if I'm wrong, but you've also got private health insurance.
Yes, I purchased a private health insurance a long time ago when I was even a student. I was on a private health insurance when I was a year. When I brought my wife from Kenya through the 457 visa as a secondary, a member of my family.
Mm-hmm.
I purchased a family, a health insurance. So I've been using my health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been paying all those years through the health insurance. I only got, after getting the bridging visa, Medicare recently. But I rarely use it, because I've actually find myself that I'm very healthy, I'm capable, I'm doing everything. I don't rely on the taxpayers' money,
mm-hmm.
the way they claim it.
Yeah, because this is why I'm still, I keep saying it, I'm trying to get my head around this decision. You know, you've done nothing but contribute to this country since you've been here, and yet all of a sudden this decision's been made, when there is someone who is changing the lives of people here in this country, not only as an academic and as an educator, because you were a teacher and a tutor, but also now as an advocate and working in the disability field. And do you feel like the law has kind of dehumanized you based on who you are? I mean, for 47 years, you've never changed. You're still the same person.
Well, I couldn't understand really the whole system of this health criteria thing, because I understand obviously I don't want to say that Australians cannot make a choice in terms of who comes and who is not coming to the country. That's a given fact. That choice depends on, you know, the government policies and all that. But mm-hmm. what is really, you know, I can't even understand myself is, with all those contributions that I've really contributed into Australian society and made my life actually 11 years having stayed here, established a lot of connections and interacted with many Australians
mm-hmm.
and even adapted Australian values, to be discriminated just because of my status, having a disability, it's something that really doesn't augur very well to me.
Mm.
And, you know, I feel that really my total humanity has been really tested.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is a challenge to a civilized country like Australia.
Definitely, and I guess too, and this is something that I've said through the last hour and a half on the show before you've come on, is that what kind of message is that sending out to the Australian disability community, especially people who are here on the same sort of visas you're here on? Well, do you think that there's going to be people getting really scared that, you know, I could be next, this, you know, and there are some people who aren't, you know, that they've come here on these bridging visas for a better life, and do you think that it's going to create fear in our country?
Yes, it's going to create fear because look, any person with a disability, really, with not even a person with a disability. If you even have a member in your family, person with a disability, whatever profession you are, whether you are a doctor, engineer, electrician, whatever, and you are contributing to the society, you really get scared.
Mm.
You really get scared because, and it's very difficult, you know, to be in that kind of a situation that you really worry about the person you love. Mm. If the person has a disability, then you start worrying, you know, without considering the contribution you make in the society.
Mm.
And it's not even alone the fact that I have a disability. The idea of even waiting 10 years, see, you have to, there's a 10 years waiting period for a migrant with a disability before they can even access welfare.
Mm.
10 years waiting period. So, well, it's really, what's you know, when other people are just having, within 6 months, mm-hmm. how many people look, how many people are really on welfare
mm-hmm.
and they're not contributing to the society.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing nothing.
Yes,
really.
Exactly.
And you find that people are not factoring all those things.
Mm-hmm.
A migrant have to wait for 10 years. My children now who were born here in Australia have to wait 10 years to be considered as Australian.
Really?
Yes. That's how it is. They are not Australians. They were born here, but they're not Australian. They have to wait for 10 years to become Australians. How do we treat people?
Well, this is the thing, Dr. Siat, and this is where it's all wrong. And I'm wondering, because you seem to have a lot of very strong people behind you here in this country supporting you. I have to give a shout out to Nikki Lakerink and Samantha Connor for putting me on to you. But I know Samantha Connor who is with People with Disabilities Australia is becoming very outspoken here. Do you think that with enough voices getting behind this that we may be able to actually approach the United Nations and tell them that our country is in breach of the convention in regards to this Migration Act, to have it changed?
Whatever it will take.
Yep.
We really need to change that legislation. Mm. We really need to consider the contribution of the person, not his disability.
Yeah.
And that's the fact that I will keep on emphasizing.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to go back to my own country now to start a new life
mm-hmm.
after living 11 years here, contributing to the society,
mm-hmm.
it's really a pain, isn't it?
Yeah. I can only imagine.
It's really hard. Yes. How do I establish myself in my home country? not that we normally say home is always the best.
Yeah.
I was born in Kenya, yes, and I still love my country, yes. I still love Australia also, because this is a place I stayed for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I made it my home.
Yeah.
So going back and then establishing, it's just living, just staying in limbo, you have one foot here and another foot there in Kenya.
it's that limbo that constantly gets brought up when these stories happen.
Exactly.
I was talking earlier about the case of Maria Sevilla, who had a son with autism in Queensland,
yes.
And she was told that she was going to have to go back to the Philippines.
Yes.
And, in listening to her story, it's a common thread that, it's that instability.
Yeah.
What's going to happen, and also the fact that your appeal, you self-funded your appeal, everything like that. So, I want to make this clear to our listeners and the Australian government that, this is a person who has pretty much paid his own way with everything, and I hate using the word burden, but do you feel that that's how they've made you feel? That you've been a burden to society and this is why you have to go?
Yes, that's how they want me to feel. Because, I come from a nomadic background.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah.
And I always look at the camel, because we use the camel. So when the camel is loaded with all those, luggage and all that, and it has to carry all that burden. Then I look at myself. Look, here, you have a creature. God created that creature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's carrying all this burden loaded on it. You see? Then when I'm told again, you are a public burden, and I'm wondering myself, look, I've stayed all this my life. I've never been a problem to anyone. I've never even been a problem to my wife.
Well, that's a big thing.
Our country tells me that you are a burden to us.
Yeah.
You see, there is no single person today who can claim that I have their debt.
Yeah.
No single agency. If you look at my credit check, it's clean. I've paid everything. I don't have anybody's bill.
Yeah.
So, and on top of that, my legal proceedings with this case, it's on my. At the same time, I'm the one who's factoring in all that cost,
mm-hmm.
and stands up to now up to $20,000 just to claim for my rights.
Yep.
You see, it doesn't really. I don't know. Wherever you go, whether it's migration agent, whether it's a legal, legal representations, all that is money,
mm-hmm.
and all that to consider it. That I have a disability, I am blind, really, it fails all logics, really.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it does, and that's what I've kept saying, is that it does. It defies logic, I can't understand it.
Yeah.
So, obviously, the appeal's been put in. Now, that can take months, can't it?
It can take 6 to 9 months.
So, does that mean that you're at least guaranteed another 6 to 9 months to fight this?
Yes.
In the hopes that Peter Dutton will actually step in and say,
well, the minister can only step in once the resolution, the appeal has been resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But the appeal will take 6 to 9 months,
mm-hmm.
and again the public will be tired by the time again I'm told to go away.
No. I think this was
six to 9 months is really a long time. Anything can happen. Look, I'm taking care of children who are teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my home country, Kenya.
Yeah. Because you are sending money back to your to your family.
Of course, I do support them. I support their education. One of them is even taking a medicine degree, is completing his degree in medicine. And I invited him here last year to come and do voluntary work in one of the hospitals.
Yeah.
That's the love I have for the Australians.
Mm.
And again, that person cannot come. It's cost. I paid for his cost, the transport and everything.
Yep.
You see? That's a person, when he comes and joins me here, he will still contribute to the Australian society.
Mm-hmm.
See? And all my other children, and my first, my daughter, she's doing nothing in Kenya. So we are professional people. We are not really a burden to anybody.
No, exactly.
So
and
I don't know. I don't know how they calculate their.
Now,
yeah, if I have to send the bill of my voluntary work that I've done to Australia, I assure you, Kelly, Nick, that is going to oversee all what they're claiming.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I started 2005 as a volunteer helping migrants to settle, refugee migrants to settle here in Australia,
mm-hmm.
in South Australia. And I did that until 2005. 12 when I left South Australia. I was still, while I was working, I was sacrificing 3 hours every day to help migrants, whether it's counseling, mentoring, and giving them support, skills, leadership, all that. See? And if I calculated my voluntary work plus my labor,
yep.
force, that will be, I don't know whether the country can even pay back.
Exactly. Well, the way our economy is at the moment, you know.
I don't know whether they can pay back.
No, exactly.
This is the realistic, you know, rational way of thinking, you know.
And this is
my contribution.
Exactly, your contributions, and I keep saying that, and this is what they need to be looking at. They need to be looking at the contribution you've been making to this country for the last 11 and a half years.
Yes.
And it's enormous. It's enormous, you know, and I hope to hear back from Peter Dutton. I really do. But I actually have to... I have to cut this interview short. I would love to speak to you for the next
yes.
hour and a
no,
half, but
no.
I want to extend an invitation for you to come to Bendigo. I would love for you to come to Bendigo. We would love to have you and your family here, and we would love to hear you speak. And obviously, we are actually talking. I would love to book you to come in 2 years, because I'm telling you, you will still be here in 2 years.
I don't know.
No, I think you will.
We are very, very optimistic. Yeah, very optimistic.
Yes, and I'm very optimistic, but just know that there are some great advocates and people in this country who want you here, and we will speak out as loud and proud as we can to keep you here.
Yes, I really appreciate, and I just really wanted to say thank you very much for the Australian people, and thank you very much for advocates and people with a disability who really supported me and stood with me and continue to fight and until to make we find that we make a difference in this society. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining me on this. It's actually rather early where you are. So thank you for taking the time to speak to me today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
You have a great weekend.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. And that was the absolutely beautiful Dr. Siat Abdi. Please, we need to get signatures on this change.org campaign that's happening. It's up on our Facebook page. When the podcast for the show comes out, please share it around. We need to get the word out. We want this man to stay in our country. He is an amazing human being who should not be discriminated against based on his disability. I'm getting a bit emotional here because he is a lovely man. I want to thank again Samantha Connor, Nikki Lakerink, and also the wonderful Sarah Hansford for making this interview possible today. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to what I believe has been a very important show. And I also want to thank Dr. Siat Abdi and his family for coming on the show today. And also thank you, Dr. Siat, for all the work that you've done and for all the change that you've brought about here in this country. Thank you so much. And if we're able to just get behind you and campaign on your behalf to keep you here, just as a mode of thanks, then so be it, we will. Okay, everybody, thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful week, and hopefully next week we may have a response from our government in relation to what is going on with Dr. Siat and his family. Have a wonderful week, people. Bye-bye.